Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
First, the government is to build approximately six large reception centres for international protection applicants, but their locations won't be made public until after the European and local elections. That's according to Pat Leahy, writing in today's Irish Times. Now, the head of the expert advisory group which recommended the construction of those centres is former Secretary General of the European Commission, Catherine Day. And Catherine Day is here in the studio with me now. You're very welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Morning, Claire.
Your response, first of all, to that report in the Irish Times today from Pat Leahy that the locations might not be decided or published, at least until after the elections in June?
Well, I think the question we're trying to deal with is how to deal well with asylum seekers in a time of housing shortage. And we have been arguing for some time that the state needs to either build or acquire accommodation through which people can pass, because we've tried the private sector model and it doesn't work. So if this is confirmed, I think it's good news. The six reception centres were included in the white paper on ending direct provision, but they were based on much smaller numbers. So I think it would be to be welcomed if the state is finally going to take responsibility for asylum seekers. And this should be the beginning of a longer process, mm-hmm. because we are seeing higher numbers now and we would need to go beyond six. But it's important to start now. And to have accommodation that's not in the private sector. So it's not competing with the tourism. It's not giving rise to the situation in Rathgray, where the only hotel in the town is taken out of normal business, let's say. And we think it's the only way to manage a problem that will not go away. Unfortunately, we will have to deal with asylum seekers for the foreseeable future.
I suppose what Pat Leahy's report tells us today is just how politically sensitive this is. And does that concern you, that, you know, the government might be looking at this going, well, we won't say anything about that now until we have those elections out of the way?
Well, one of the things we have recommended is much earlier engagement with local communities. I know there is some, and I know that the officials are frustrated by seeing that despite their best efforts, there still are problems. But we think they need to start much earlier. People see when a building is being renovated in their locality, and not telling them what it's for builds up suspicion. It allows rumours to develop which are not based on fact. So we think as soon as the state is deciding on where to locate accommodation centres, it should begin a process of engagement. And it shouldn't only be with the TDs and councillors. It should be with the civil society in the area. I know they don't want to do that because maybe the project won't continue for a whole lot of reasons. But we think it would be better to have the engagement because it brings people into an understanding and gives them an opportunity to say what's worrying them, even if the project doesn't go through. But if it does go through, it's very important to have community involvement, because our view is that most people want to be helpful. They want to be open. There's lots of good examples around the country of local communities opening their hearts and their time to integrating asylum seekers. But it's not. It has to be that goodwill has to be fostered, and people have to have information. In the end, the state has to make a decision about where to put them. But it should be in a different context and in a climate of greater understanding and willingness to help. The other thing is that if you have a large number of people in a small town putting pressure on existing services that are already overstretched, then it surely is not beyond the capacity of a whole of government approach to say we will provide extra classrooms, extra teachers, extra GPs, in order to make it possible for the local community to be welcoming.
You explained that your work began when the government decided it wanted to end direct provision. But when we look at what is suggested, these reception centres, how would that differ? Because surely they would be run under contract into the private sector. I mean, the building and the land might be owned by the state, but then how would they differ?
Well, first of all, if the state owns the building, the state is getting more for the amount of money it's spending, because at the moment the state is basically paying for bed nights, but it has no asset at the end of that. So if the state owned the premises, it could reuse it constantly. We also want the processing times to be shortened. At the moment, they are being shortened. At the moment, it's the median time to process an application is about 12 months. But we think the International Protection Office has already shown it can do do this in under 6 months if it has enough staff. And we think the faster the system works, the better it is for everybody. So those two things would be different. And so these would not be in competition, let's say, with the tourism sector for hotels and bed and breakfast. Also, they would not be competing with private purchasing of housing, etc.
But I suppose when it came to direct provision, there were a lot of concerns around the level of care that was provided in those places. So yes. Are you saying that the state should have full control over that?
Absolutely. And the state should set the standards. And another recommendation was made some time ago, which the state has taken up, but only partially, is that HICWA should inspect the facilities. This would be in the period before the state owned accommodation comes on stream. But there's a big difference between what we collectively call direct provision. Mm-hmm. Some of the facilities are absolutely up to standard, but HICWA has now started to assess and inspect. And it's important to have an independent inspection to make sure that where we put people, even temporarily, is up to standard.
I want to ask in more detail about the recent protests that we have seen. You know, people saying things like Ireland is full, mentioning that specific towns are full. We don't want unvetted males. How do you view those concerns as they're expressed?
Well, I think you have to take them seriously. If that's what people are worrying, I think you have to explain to them, how does the system work? So when somebody comes here and applies for asylum, they are photographed and fingerprinted, and they have to give a lot of detail about where have they come from, why have they come here. I don't think people know that, and why should they? It's not something you would normally know. So that has to be explained. And that's why we have been saying that there are no unvetted males, because everybody has to go through this process. We think that it's very important to look from the beginning at where people will go. If you decide faster, people can then either move on with their lives and build a new life in Ireland, or they will have to leave. And I think that's also an important part of the overall process. To have people stuck for 2 or 3 years in direct provision without a decision makes it almost impossible to deport them or to encourage them to leave afterwards. But if you have a quick turnaround, you can make sure that people who are not considered to have a valid case will have to leave. And then in terms of who actually runs the centres, that could be contracted out, but it will be within a completely different system of state ownership, state setting of standards, and a faster throughput. If people then go through the system and get a decision within 6 months, then they have to find accommodation, and that's the next hurdle. At the moment, the local authorities are not including any estimate of these people in the local housing needs, and that needs to be adjusted. Because people who flee their own country and can't go back, if they get leave to remain in Ireland, they are the most likely to stay. So we've got to start counting those numbers of people in as well. And again, finding where they can go, where they can be an asset to local communities. Some parts of the country are worried about depopulation. So, you know, we could, what we have suggested is a population key for each county so that people can be attributed according to capacity to receive them, according to what the numbers they already have. It needs to be rethought in a holistic way.
And again,
it can't be left to one department.
The resources need to be put in if you're
Absolutely.
Going to increase the population in that area. We had a long discussion on the programme yesterday about deportation in Ireland. If somebody is refused asylum and that their appeal is turned down, we don't seem to have a good handle on the number of people who are leaving the state when they are asked to leave. Does that all form part of this, that you're giving people assurances that the system is working?
I think you have to. I think all these talks about invasion and all the rest of it come from a fear of, well, how can we control our borders? And Ireland is not unique in this. The whole of the European Union is trying to grapple with the problem. And I think rejecting claims that are not valid is also part of the system. And we haven't looked in particular at that aspect, but I do think it's something that the Department of Justice is looking at and will need to be able to explain to people that people only get to stay in Ireland if their case is accepted under the Irish system. It's not sufficient just to arrive in Ireland and then you can stay here. I think that is something that worries people, and we have to deal with that as well.
You mentioned there that we could look at areas of the country that have low populations. have you set out or have you looked at where these centres should be, or will it be dictated by, well, we have public land available there, so we'll put one of these reception centres in that place?
Well, I think it'll be a mix because for the state has a lot of land around the country. Some of it is not in suitable areas, some of it is in suitable areas. So they'll have to make a decision. But we would like the wider picture to be taken into account as well. So to think about which are the counties which already have a high proportion of asylum seekers compared to the local population. Where is there a capacity of services? Where is it easier to place a big number of people rather than in areas that are already oversubscribed, mm-hmm. let's say? And that this is why we are calling for a whole of government approach to this. It's not enough just to expect Minister O'Gorman and his very hard-pressed and very hard-working few staff to deal with all of this. A lot of other departments have to be involved as well in bringing their contribution to the table and saying, well, if it was here, we could deal with it easier than if it was somewhere else. You know, we are a small country. I mean, it's not that difficult to get the right people together and to press them to come up with workable solutions.
Well, all of the government departments were asked to identify land for housing. So are we now going to go back and say, well, is there any of that land that you identified for housing that you could now devote to having a reception centre built on?
I can't be categoric on that, but I don't think it's necessary to do that. The state has a lot of land. And what we've been arguing for is that you shouldn't put people out in the wilds. They need services, so they need to be close to towns where they can have services. But I don't, again, I think there is no need to put these things in competition with one another. The state has plenty of land, and it needs to use a different lens when it's deciding where to put these reception centres. People will be transiting through them. They won't be staying there long term. So they need to have some facilities, but not permanent facilities like when you're looking for land for permanent housing for people.
So this is what we're talking about. Reception centres, you will stay here while your application is being
processed.
Decided. So have you looked then at accommodation for afterwards, even in the short to medium term?
Yes, that's phase two of the white paper, which involves also helping local authorities to expand the number of houses that they are going to be building. Because, as I say, if people get permission to remain in Ireland, then they have the same rights as everybody else living in the country, and they can apply to be citizens, and most of them will over time. So we've got to take those numbers into account as well. So, in fact, what we're saying is the planning for future housing has to be expanded by at least an estimate of the number of people who will get leave to remain in the country.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think that number will be? Is it possible to predict?
It's not down to the last person, but all you can go on is trends. But if you think about it, the developed world is a very prosperous, secure, safe place to be. Here in Ireland, the state is not our enemy. The state works for us. That's not the case for people fleeing from countries where the state is persecuting them. So Europe and other havens of prosperity and security will continue to be places where people will want to seek asylum. So we have seen an increase in the numbers, not huge. I mean, we're talking about probably under 14,000 last year and this year. So in a growing population of 5.2 million, we are certainly able to accommodate those numbers if we make the plans for them. And we feel that I don't see the state of the world improving anytime soon. So apart from wars and religious and ethnic persecution, you will also have climate change driving people to seek asylum as well. So we just need to gear up for that. And as an ageing society and a country that has lots of job vacancies, we should also be looking to this influx of people as an opportunity. If we have lots of people seeking asylum who have different skills, maybe they need to upgrade their skills, maybe they need, you know, intensive English language training. But instead of regarding people either as a problem or as something to be hidden, we should be saying, OK, we are going to be granting asylum to approximately so many people in the forthcoming period. How do we help them to integrate, and how do we make their arrival an advantage? Because all of the studies show that people who are forced to leave and settle somewhere else, they are the people with the get up and go because they have no support where they are. They have to make it on their own.
In the medium term, though, we are still going to face again and again, it would seem, situations like we saw in Ross Grey. Do you have any answer to that in the short to medium term?
I don't think we necessarily will face problems like Ross Grey because if the state has sufficient capacity and, as I said, the six reception centres were based on a calculation of 3,500 asylum seekers a year, we think we should be calculating on the basis of maybe 10 to 15,000. So if people know that when they arrive and seek asylum, they will be in these centres, then there won't be any competition with the local hospitality sector because this will be accommodation that's outside of, let's say, the norm temporarily. What we do have to do then is to, as the housing situation improves anyway, the pressure will be less and it will be easier for people getting leave to remain in Ireland to find accommodation. And there are several charities and NGOs working to help those asylum seekers who get leave to remain to move on into the community now. I think about 100, 150 a month are moving out of direct provision when they get leave to remain, helped by organisations like DePaul and others to find accommodation.
But until we get these reception centres up and running, we're going to continue to have the problems that we see now.
Well, that's why I think we need, first of all, much better outreach and explanation. And secondly, I do think if people can see that there is a solution coming, they will understand that it can't be put in place from one month to the next, but that the problem is going to be dealt with and that we do have a long-term strategy and a whole-of-government approach, then I think most people will be reasonable.
Your original report said that direct provision could be ended by 2024.
Yes.
You're saying now that that's impossible.
Yes.
Do you have a new date in mind or do you think it's possible?
I think it is possible and I think it's both desirable and necessary. I might be a bit more reluctant to put a precise date on it. I can see the factors that need to be in place, which will enable us eventually to say we have ended direct provision, we have moved to a system which is better for everybody. But of course, when we did the original report, it was before COVID, it was before the Ukrainian crisis, before many of the other crises. But I think what this tells us is that we have to move away from treating asylum as a temporary problem that will go away someday to accepting that it's a permanent part of modern life and that we have to have long-term workable solutions in place to cope with it. And I think that will be much better for everybody.
Thank you very much for coming in. That's Catherine Day, former Secretary General of the European Commission. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.